You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 124. Today's episode is about the Mississippi River and the Batcher along it. Don't know what it is or where it is or how to say it? Well, stay tuned and find out. Before we get there, I want to tell you about the last episode. It was a Q&A show where I answered a bunch of questions from listeners like you. They're always fun and popular, and they cover a wide variety of topics. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. With that, I want to jump into today's discussion about the Mississippi River Batcher. To do that, I'm joined by an author, professor, lawyer, who spent much of his life on environmental issues in Louisiana. He also wrote several books, but the book today we're going to talk about specifically about the Batcher called Down on the Batcher. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Oliver Hawk. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I'm out of breath. It's a warm November day, and I jogged over here. I want to get into the book, but I want to talk a little bit about your background because it's so much more than your interest in the Batcher. I guess as a start, how long have you been here at Tulane?
Well, I am an accidental Louisianan. I think a lot of us are.
Yeah.
A lot of people come down here and sort of fall in. That was true for me. I was I was general counsel for the National Wildlife Federation in Washington, D.C. in the 1970s. And one of the very first things that happened was a telephone call from a Cajun down here named Charlie Bosch. He ran a hunting and fishing organization called the Louisiana Wildlife Federation. And he said, "You got to get down here, save Shafalai." I didn't know what it was. What's that kind of a fish? Is it a bird? What is it? And I said, okay. And so I came down, and it turned out that the Corps of Engineers was channelizing the Atchafalaya Swamp west of here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this very expensive operation. They were spending, at that time, $2 billion. Today,
wow.
20 plus.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was good. When the river got high, the water would be flushed down the Atchafalaya floodway, and that would save it from flooding New Orleans. No one could impeach that. So, but they were trying to develop the floodway by enlarging, by cutting a big channel down the middle of it, just like the Mississippi Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And what that would do would be cut off the overflow. And what that would do, dry up the swamp and drain the swamp.
Sure.
So that was what Charlie was all about. Don't drain the swamp. Save the Atchafalaya was the cry. So we went down and met with the Corps, and we started a campaign. I had a running gun battle with the Corps for commuting down from Washington.
Hmm.
For the next 10 years. That would be 70 to 80. And then in 1980, I had a magic moment. The people most intent on having the Atchafalaya dried out were the landowners because they saw instant real estate. They would have property that went for $20 an acre suddenly be $10,000 an acre. And they had already started building housing complexes in the middle of the floodway. This is where 1.5 million cubic feet per second would come pouring down.
Great.
At half of the Mississippi flow at high flood. And one was called the Atchafalaya Acres, if you can believe it. And so we were able to persuade the Corps that it was not in their interest to dry up the basin, that they couldn't keep people out of it. And furthermore, if they dug a big ditch down the middle of it, it couldn't maintain itself. It would silt up.
Sure.
Because at low flow, all that stuff would drop out. So it was biologically and politically a loser. And the Corps had a very enlightened duo of chief engineers at the time, Vald Heiberg and Tom Sands. Vald went on to be chief of engineers.
Hmm.
Tom Sands went on to be chief of the Mississippi Valley Division, which is the King Division of the Corps,
right.
has 50% of all the work in the country. Very well connected to make this thing go right. And so we cut a deal with the landowners, and we agreed we would not buy out the basin entirely. We'd buy out some to keep it completely safe, but we had what we call comprehensive easements, no development easements. So they couldn't cut down the trees. They couldn't they couldn't put it into soybeans. Status quo, we call them. Well, of course, Newman and the landowners didn't mind that because they were getting paid damn near full fee simple.
Right.
And that didn't bother me. It was just the U.S. Treasury paying and, you know,
sure.
fewer money for bombs as far as I was concerned. That was the deal. But in order to cut that deal, I had to negotiate it. So I came, took leave in Washington from the Wildlife Federation and came down here for a year. And I needed a place to be while I was here, to stay and to work from. So I came to Tulane and I said, look, I'll offer you some free courses. Just let me stay here. And so by some enormous circumstance, Tulane's criminal law professor had just announced he was leaving to join the faculty at Columbia. And so the dean, back from vacation, had a resignation letter on his desk, and he's looking at it, and like, he gets a phone call from me saying, you know, I'd like to talk to you about teaching at Tulane. He can say, what can you teach? And I said, well, I used to be a criminal prosecutor. I can teach criminal law. And he says, okay, come see us. And within a week, he made this offer, and I came down for 1 year. That's all the year I needed, because then I would go back to Washington.
Sure.
But like I say, you get into Louisiana, you stay there.
It gets in your pores, I think.
Oh, God, in my pores. I love teaching here at Tulane, and they were okay with that, and I've been here ever since.
What a great story. You and I did not talk about this before we turned on the mic, but we have a couple of overlaps there in that before I'm a native of New Orleans and was gone for many years. And before I came back to raise our girls, we spent the previous 8 years in Washington, D.C. And then when you talk about the Atchafalaya Basin, I think so much when people maybe in New Orleans think about coastal restoration and preservation, they think about down near Grand Isle. But of course, the Atchafalaya is such a driver of what happens in the Mississippi River. I went to school at, it's now University of Louisiana, but at USL in Lafayette. And as you were talking about developing or people wanting to develop that land, I think back when I was there in the 80s, the mid-80s, it's swamp and it's fast moving water when that water.
Yes, it is.
People don't think about that.
It's 15 miles an hour. And it's moving. It's a wall. It's like having a tsunami come down there.
And it's wide.
But the crazy thing was at the base of the floodway is a town called Morgan City.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right. This is the bullseye. And the floodway goes down and stops and then has little outlets around both sides of it. Well, high enough water, it's going to end up in Venezuela. It's just going to wash out. They were the greatest champions of the Corps dredging project.
Really?
Couldn't ever persuade them otherwise.
And now here we jump forward to 2020, and so much of the wetlands loss in that part of the state affects, you know, Lafayette is almost a coastal town now. Morgan City's still there, but gosh, we've had such an active storm season this year with several storms going right into that.
Yeah, you know, in terms of my Louisiana work, I morphed once we solved the Atchafalaya, and it was really a win-win. The Corps won, we won. I've since been involved in saving the coast and in litigation to do that, basically to try to get the oil and gas companies to pay for destroying the coast.
Sure.
Because most of the destruction and the loss out there was caused by them.
Mm-hmm.
Not just their canals, but all that stuff they excavated from under the marshes. In fact, the science community has taken to say that the marshes didn't die just on the top. They were sunk. They were excavated.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you're drilling underneath, you're collapsing the ocean floor,
absolutely.
Right? And it's one of those things. You, as a Louisianian, we think about, if you look at a map, it shows us as a boot, but in reality, that boot is no longer in existence.
No.
So much of that land is gone. It's nowhere near
the toes. And the, right. The ball of the foot is in trouble. The heel is still there.
But what brought me to you was this idea of the Batcher. And maybe first for our listeners, can you explain what the Batcher is?
Yeah, well, the Corps had the idea of confining the Mississippi River for flood purposes, and that was quite legitimate. They had a choice of doing that or building ever more higher levees forever and ever. And, of course, John Barry describes how that didn't work very fully in his book, Rising Tide, a wonderful book.
Yes.
And so when they built the levees, they're building the levees against rises and falls of the river. So the levees are built back to accommodate high rise of the river. Mm-hmm. But when the river drops, it drops precipitously, and there's a lot of land exposed on the river side. And that is where the water beats against the land, and the word for beats is battre in French. And so this is the batture, or batcher. And so the beautiful spot is the only undeveloped space in New Orleans, even in the region. I mean, it's just undeveloped, and it can't be developed. Not because anybody put a zoning out there, but because anything that goes in there is going to get drowned.
Right.
And there are a few little houses built on stilts that project over it. But other than those 13 little houses, nobody's up there but the Corps of Engineers.
And those, since you mentioned it, those houses are very, very close to the Orleans Parish, Jefferson Parish line.
Right on it. Mm-hmm.
And there's always litigation about those houses, right?
Because not really. That's pretty much settled.
Is it?
Yeah. That land was owned by a family called O'Dwyer. Hmm. And the O'Dwyers were part of the Irish mafia here, the old O'Dwyers. They were prominent people. They gave heartily to the church. They were church leaders to the Catholic Church. Old man O'Dwyer was also an aficionado of birds, and he built the largest aviary in Louisiana. It was like an Audubon zoo of birds in his backyard out of largely bamboo cages. And he had birds from all over the world. And they had school tours for free. And rock stars coming through New Orleans would, hey, here's a cool thing to do. And they'd go out and see these collections of birds, because there wasn't any Audubon Zoo then. So that's the family. And they owned the land. They owned that batch of land.
And there's, right, like you said, 12 or 13 houses there.
But unfortunately, the younger the son of this empire family was a lawyer, and he was very cantankerous. And he was his own worst enemy. So when he filed a case to remove them, and the case just stalled and stalled and stalled. Meanwhile, his histrionics were making national press. He was accusing judges of blackmail and everything, and he was disbarred, and it was nasty. So even though he had a valid suit, he couldn't possibly win it. And he didn't.
Right.
And so those people were spared.
And they're really the only people that live legally on the Batcher.
Yes.
We were talking before you and I turned on the microphone that there are homeless encampments there from time to time. But it's fluid because, like you said, that land is constantly shifting and the water
homeless
levels.
Homeless encampments is even a an ornate word for what's going on down
Fair
there.
Fair enough.
Every once in a while, and usually it's very transitory. For a month or two, there might be kind of derelict men, sometimes women, who kind of hole up in there, in the brush, out of sight, and they put up tents. They make tents out of canvas. They cook their meals there, and they live there. And that's died out recently because the Corps has cinched, really cut back the trees at the and right near New Orleans, sure. really cut them back.
Yeah,
and so they don't have hiding places anymore.
Sure.
They also, if you're familiar with the way this is, this lines up. The geography is that the Mississippi comes down past New Orleans and the Corps of Engineers building. Everything from the Corps of Engineers building and below is paved and gone.
Mm-hmm.
It is walled off. When you get north of the Corps, you pass a small patch of woods, which in the book I described in detail because I would walk my dog there a lot. In fact, I came onto the Badger because I was looking for a place to walk my dog.
And this is the area in Carrollton, where St. Charles Avenue and Carrollton meet at the river
right there.
That Cooter Brown.
And it didn't have to walk him far, and he, you know, it was his own wilderness.
Sure.
And mine too, because once you get in there, yep. it's you and the river, you feel like Huck Finn.
As soon as you get beyond into it, it feels like stepping through the wardrobe, right?
Yeah.
It's a completely different feeling.
One night when I was bicycling up on the levee top, it was before they paved it. It was paved at that point with range of clamshells from the Lake Pontchartrain, mm-hmm. but it was a smooth surface. And coming back downstream, suddenly I saw, it was late, it was night, I saw lights coming at me like a birthday cake. And then there was another. And then I heard organ music. And then I heard bands playing, and it was the City of New Orleans and the Mississippi Belle, the great paddle wheelers, and they're having a race. And they were racing from New Orleans to Vicksburg.
What a sight.
And I stopped and just listened to that party as they went by and all that. And you talk about going back in time. I mean, I was, you know, I felt strange in my bike shorts, you know?
And in your book, you go through numerous stories, and we can certainly talk about some of them, where it does very much, to me, feel like Narnia and stepping through the wardrobe. The moment you get off the levee and go down and through the brush, even there, but certainly as you go up towards Ochsner and into Jefferson Parish and keep going, it doesn't take many steps to where you feel transported.
Absolutely.
Into time.
The beauty part of the, not only did you have the vegetation, but the levee blocks off the automobile sound. So that's just cut off.
It's very peaceful,
quickly. And the only sounds are the sounds from the river. And, of course, that's Mark Twain time. I mean, sometimes you hear the whistles, but you just see those great big tankers going up and down, and the barges pushing 16 barges at a time, one tug.
I think you mentioned that in the book, and I had the experience very recently of being down in there on a foggy morning, and I at once was sort of in awe of the tugs pushing all those barges, and then had a moment of dread in thinking about how much skill it must take, but how easy it would be for that to come awry.
Every once in a while, one of those things goes ashore, including some of the big tankers.
Sure.
And the reason they do is that when rivers go fast, they're going much faster than the river along the bank because it's getting held back by the tension of the levee.
Mm-hmm.
So the river is actually going downstream in the middle, and it's swirling back upstream in the levee. And so that's something that river pilots have to be very careful of, because if they get out of the main current, suddenly they're getting sucked up and in.
Hmm.
And so one came nosed in just above the last Batcher house once, and I was up there. And they had a hell of a time getting it off. I mean, it was a day getting it off the bank, off the Batcher. They were pushing it with bulldozers at this side, and they had tugs pulling on the other side. Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting right there that the area we were talking about, first of all, still has some woods, although it's been cut back near Cooter Brown's. And then as you go past the Batcher houses, kind of even with Southport Music Hall, which has a long history
mm-hmm.
with the Mafia and with that area, and now for the last several years has been reopened as Southport
yep.
Music Hall. But you go up a little bit from there, and there's a wide open space, so you really can see the...
Let me tell you something about that wide open space. That used to be the really choice snuffing. You know, if you really wanted to get away, it was in that section. And it goes up about half a mile. It's below the bridge. Mm-hmm. It's between where the telephone lines are in Ochsner and then the bridge. That whole section was treed. Mm. And the Corps had an improvement project, and they were going to stabilize the riverbank. And it's a pretty unsuccessful operation, but every couple of years they drop more rocks on it in the hopes that they'll keep the Mississippi from eating up the bank. Well, it eats up the rocks, that's for sure. And it's sort of, it's like brushing your teeth. You got to do it a lot, but you don't have much of a choice. And so, but they were involved in this operation, which I didn't mind at all. But as I'm riding by, I notice they're taking down all the trees.
Hmm.
And I said, see, so I called them up. I called up the chief of the engineering division. And I said, you know, this isn't, you know, I teach at Tulane, and I don't have any problem with your fixing the bank. But you don't need to take those trees. Can't you save at least the big ones? And so he said, get this, aren't you the guy who wrote the book? Holy cow! And he says, we love the book. We pass it around the office. Now, the book is somewhat critical of the Corps.
Yes,
but
yes.
We love the book because the Corps know when they're doing something stupid. And so the Corps then, he made me a promise that he would leave the big trees. So the trees you see next are almost like a park.
Mm-hmm.
There's grass and that level to the river, no tangle.
Mm-hmm.
And these are poplar trees. They're gorgeous. They have bark of gray and white blotches like camo, and they have great big leaves, and they're wonderful specimens. And my wife calls them Ollie's trees.
I will remember that next time I'm out there.
What you have to do, though, if you want to get the feel of the bachelor, and nobody knows this. I've never seen anyone else up in there except maybe a local or two. When you get up river under the bridge, you'll pass a golf course.
You mean past the Huey Long Bridge?
Huey Long.
Right.
Then there's a golf course right there. If you park at the golf course and then go in the woods there, you have about a 3 or 4 mile walk in the Bachelor along a path along the river.
Hmm.
And it is... real, it feels like wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like, well, you'll hear boat noises and stuff, but otherwise, you won't see a soul. And there's a lot of poison ivy in there. There's snakes. There's a reason people don't go in, but even that, no trespassing signs up there. But, you know, the signs don't have eyes.
Right.
You know, and nobody, no... levy police are going to go down in the woods to get you. So, yeah.
In fact, I came out of the woods recently, and there was a very near the Batcher houses, and there was a levy policeman right up at the top.
Yeah,
and he just said hi and you know moved on. He's not worried about me. You know, your book Down on the Batcher, you describe so many stories of wandering through with your dog, with your wife. And it really intrigued me. And even though it sounds like it's much changed from even when you wrote the book, it is still well worth exploring.
One of the things that is still there, and then I'm going to have to
yes, sir.
Cut. But just opposite Ochsner, past the power line, there's a patch of woods. And there are barges that are moored right against the bank in order to buttress the high water of the Mississippi, because it's making a big curve there, an elbow.
Yeah.
And so it's coming smashing into the base of that, the crook of that, the base of that elbow. And so this is in order to keep, to preserve the land behind it. Now those barges then are parallel, they're beached parallel to the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And when the water goes down, they're sort of high and dry. And once I was up there walking with my dog, and I noticed that someone had begun painting a portrait First of all, the first barges had crazy-looking animals, giant armadillos and giant crocodile jaws and that kind of stuff, fun stuff. And then another one was of a woman's face. And that happened sequentially. First, I saw the chin, I saw the rough sketching, and I went back another weekend, and then I saw something else. And when it was finally done, it was a beautiful Latin-looking woman with dark skin, white eyes, dark iris, hair that floated out into kind of a cypress canopy, and very red lips and a bright smile. And it said, Liliana, and then a birth date, and then a death date. Now, in order to do this, the painter, who was unknown to me, I have no idea who this painter was, would have to have taken in his paints and a ladder and gotten up there in secret, all by himself, and take his stuff out so you didn't see old buckets or brushes. In a way, it was like a cemetery. It was a sacred place.
Sure.
So it was really cool.
Well, and that's why, and I know you're pressed for time, and that's why I wanted to talk to you. I'm going to put links in the show notes to the podcast, which will be at beyondbourbonst.com, to Down on the Batcher, and we were discussing some of your other books. I'll put links there. But what I mostly wanted people was to hear in your voice some of the stories come alive, and there are many of them in the book, and to really encourage people. The podcast is called Beyond Bourbon Street for a reason, and there's so much to explore in New Orleans. And in the case of the Batcher, it's right there. And it is...
The strangest things happen. We found, I came across once, a couple of guys with sticks and clubs chasing rabbits across the levee top and beating them to death.
And you tell that story in the book.
I was appalled. I thought later, though, I mean, what the hell? We shoot them. I mean, what's different about this? But they were using golf club. One had a golf club.
Right, that's the story you're telling. Golf club. I haven't come across anything that crazy. I have seen some really impressive art.
Oh, yes.
Really impressive art. Some of it constructed of things. Some of it spray painted.
It used to be that Tulane School of Architecture gave a field exercise exam, and they were to go to that open area below the power lines, find anything they could, wire, fishing net, poles, branches, and make something.
That's pretty amazing.
Those things are wonderful.
It's a wonderful place to explore. Anyway, I just want to thank you so much for your time and for the book. It is such a wonderful book, and I hope that the listeners will not only read it, but when you're in New Orleans, whether you live here or you're coming to visit, if you think you've done everything in the city, take some time. Go up on the levee and then go down off the levee and just
I think it probably is the most different book about New Orleans you'll ever read.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and you have me fascinated with the Batcher. I live close enough to explore it several times a week now. So thank you so much for joining
me. Well, thanks for this opportunity to talk with you. Bye now.
Bye.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.